Hi, everybody. It's Jean Nathan. This is Crosstown Conversations with news about New Orleans that counts, about our economy, our environment, our culture, and some occasional politics. Thank you for joining and enjoy the show.
I know that we can.
I know darn well we can work it out. Well, yes, we can. I know we can, can. Yes, we can, can. Or why can't we if we want to? Yes, we can, can.
I know we can make it work. I know we can make it if we try.
Oh, yes, we can. I know we can, can. Yes, we can.
Great gosh, you might.
Oh, yes, we can. I know we can, can.
All right, well, Kalamu, you got me reading something, reading a parts of a book, which I haven't done in a long time. My eyes have declined, but I did delve into the book, and it was a rewarding experience. I have always been a poetry fan, but I don't think I've read poetry in years, because I haven't read, even though I have bought books that I want to read, I just haven't. So this was an important little experience for me. And if you don't mind, I am going to start our conversation with the poet and activist in his days on Earth. And I might add, judging from the poetry section, that I happened totally randomly to select quite the lover. And that's been a part of your life, which I would never have guessed, because you have a kind of austere affect. Uh-huh. And so, it was interesting to delve into some of your work. And what I'm going to do, if you don't mind, is I'm going to read a few totally miscellaneous parts of your writing, just sentences, just disconnected sentences that grabbed my attention.
Whichever way you want to proceed is fine.
All right, just in order to kind of get us into the groove a little bit. So I think the first poem I read was, I thought of this as I passed in the hallway and you looked up while drying off from stepping out of your Sunday shower.
The shower, yes.
Right. And so in a lover's eye, one can see something, perhaps a glint of this potent beauty we all long to be when we giddily cast our fate to the whims of desire. And even if we have never pranced high-stepping at the front of satisfaction's parade, most of us have nevertheless stood close enough to the drumming to reflect the shudder of sensuality coiled within the trembling of impatient flesh awaiting the release of touch. I love that idea of the release of touch. That whole section closes with a line that says, whenever carrying the bowl of contradictions commonly called love. So that speaks to anyone. Then the next one you had was, I want to talk about you.
Yeah.
I'm not going to read that much of it. I'm just going to say, some call a civilized nation has been a bitter centuries long, long, long. After the chains fell, our unhealed scars, our serious sores, still too tender to touch. And about how few of us really comprehend the enormity of our history of captivity. And I would have to add to that anything that we've experienced that gave us pain. Those scars, especially the pain that was strong and persistent, it just doesn't go away. It pops up sometime when you're falling asleep or when you're waking up or...
could be anytime.
The word woke, which I thought was so interesting, as you used it, claimed it, mm-hmm. As an expression used in the African-American community, before it was stolen by some of these guys in the Trump camp. Another paragraph that I want to call out is, I am so impressed by the beauty of a people who can survive the public display of our privates, who could rise the next morning, face the pain, and still believe in living a good life. And that to me is another version of the resilience of human beings in general that we always call out, especially here in storm country, where so much devastating destruction happens any hurricane season. We just never know when it's going to come. And the impact of it varies randomly, just like any tornado. It's so random. And when it hits you, you wonder, why did it hit me? But you go on. So the onlooker could not feel the river of emotions flowing beneath the calm of our conversation. How do you say, is it Essam or Esam?
Esam.
Esam. I don't know what you were thinking about, but I'm certain I know I was thinking about you. And now I am writing this a day later on another day like most days, except today is the last Thursday in November when America celebrates a holiday, giving thanks for all they stole. Most of us render praise unto the Lord who shouldn't. Our hosannas be deviled, but shouldn't our hosannas be devil do? Fortunately, I don't believe in all of that, any of that. I believe in life in all its contradictions. I try to avoid absolutes and sentimentalities, regrets and raw maudlin thoughts about could have been, should have been, and anything other. I learned that expression here in New Orleans. I don't know if it's much more pervasive elsewhere. Kalamu, I just want to add a couple more just words. There's a paragraph that you talk about the schizophrenia that marks the Negro being. And you say, as you became conscious when he was younger, when you were younger, as we often say, as I woke up and tried to figure a lot of this out, I was confounded. So I think that it's very hard. And that seems to be one of the core issues that you address in your work, in your poetry, in your other forms of writing. So I kind of want to start there and ask, am I right in saying that that is a prominent issue for you?
I think it's a prominent issue for all human beings, the contradictions of existence, of human existence. If you are alive, well, old folks used to say, if you live, your time will come. And there are a couple of things that I should say in answering that question. First, a number of the excerpts of the writing that you read, including the titles of some of the poems and lines from some of the poems, all of that's influenced by the major musician whom influenced me. And that's John Coltrane. So I want to talk about you is actually a song that was done by Billy Eckstein, but it was Coltrane's version of that song that got me to deal with the meaning of I want to talk about you. Because when we say I want to talk about you, we often end up talking about ourselves and why it is that we relate to the person we want to talk about. You know, so if you want to talk about a lover, a parent, a sibling, or whatever, you really are talking about why you as a person relate to them, not about them and who they are. And so many of those poems, And the lines that don't seem to have a musical reference actually do. So that when you read about the rain, Coltrane has a composition After the Rain. And I thought about how I felt after a rain, which it often rains in New Orleans. So forth and so on. And it continues on throughout all of those pieces. There are references that are actually quote unquote musical references, but you would have no idea that they're musical references the way they're used. But I know that's what would trigger them.
That's not surprising in a way. I mean, I mentioned that I liked poetry. I was always engaged with it. I particularly liked E.E. Cummings. He was one of my favorite poets. But I couldn't help in reading this material, and I will have to admit that it's the first time I've read your work, because I just haven't been. I find that it's hard to both do and write about it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons, there were more than one reasons why I left television. Some of it wasn't by choice and some of it was. But I do feel that it's kind of hard to, the activities are very different. Making something happen and having that impetus, that energy, that it's not fearlessness, but it is an avoidance of fear. It's just tamping down fear and moving on is how you do. And then in the writing, you don't avoid anything. You really delve into the issues at heart that you are aware of and maybe try to avoid in order to do. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes any sense, but that's how I feel about it. But so when you're trying to both do and write about it, I think that's very hard. And you do that. And by the way, I just want to mention the fact that Gilbert Moses was a close friend of Tannen's and mine.
Uh-huh.
He, from Boston days, when Tannen lived in Boston. And I woke up one morning in my room that I shared with a woman creative. And I looked across the room and there was this guy that I had never seen before in the bed. And I looked up and I just said, "Who are you?" And it was Gilbert Moses.
Uh-huh.
And shortly after that, as I was putting some breakfast together, and I got over the surprise of seeing this person I didn't know in the same room with me sleeping, he was listening to me, and we were talking, and he was listening to me, and he said, "I want you to bend over." I said, "What?" He said, "Bend over." So I dutifully bent over, knowing implicitly that it wasn't a sexual reference, although it had that edge to it. And he said, "Now start talking." And so I start talking. And he said, "Now keep talking and just sit, stand up." So I did. And that was the only vocal lesson I've ever had. And it changed the way I talked forever. The other time the way I talked was changed forever was from a teacher. I went to an all girls high school in the Bronx. I found boys to be a pain in the ass in junior high school and I wanted no part of that. So I went to Walton High School, which is the sister school to Clinton, if you ever heard of Clinton.
Yeah.
And my English teacher, somebody played a tape with my voice on it and I listened and I had this thick Saturday Night Live Bronx accent. I was holy crap, that's me. And I set out to lose that accent. And my English teacher in school helped me do that. And teachers, and this is the other thing that was in your material, are so important. Mrs. Nelson.
Yes.
Who you cite as having an impact. Tell me more about Mrs. Nelson, because so often when I do the interviews I do, somebody is going to tell me about a Mrs. Nelson in their life.
Well, I had two teachers. Well, I need to back up because there are a lot of innocent.
Just pulling you all over the place. I'm ADD. I apologize. Go ahead.
No, there are a lot of intersecting lines. First of all, that was during a period. My mother was an elementary school teacher. She taught third grade. And I, as the child of a teacher, I went to school for my elementary years wherever she was teaching. First at Fisk, up off of what is now Norman Francis Parkway in Tulane, not too far from there. And then at Phyllis Wheatley, who was the first major African-American poet to be published in the United States, although she wasn't, her first publication was done in England, but she was known as a you know, African-American poet, and in fact, the first published African-American poet in the United States, because she was enslaved in the Boston area. And then when I graduated from Phyllis Wheatley, seventh grade, I ended up at Rivers Frederick Junior High School in the Seventh Ward. What is significant is that Rivers Frederick was a physician. I knew he was a doctor, but that's all I knew about him. And while working on a current project, which is coming out soon, Seeing Black, Photography in New Orleans, 1840 and Beyond. Photography was developed in France. Daguerre is the process that we know now, the process is named after Daguerre. It became the most popular way of photography. There were others. But in 1839, he developed the technique. And a man who was domiciled in New Orleans but born in France, Jules Leon, happened to be in France at the time that Daguerre developed the photography. And he learned it and brought it back to New Orleans in 1840. He was a painter and lithographer by trade. In fact, his lithograph, he has a lithograph of St. Louis Cathedral, which is the most prominent of his work, and is often cited in books that trace New Orleans history, et cetera, et cetera. But so that development, and he brought back photography to New Orleans. So New Orleans has the distinction of being the major city with native born or people who moved here and ended up being domiciled here in terms of photography, early photography. And he brought that back to New Orleans, and it was, and Jules Leon had an exhibition and so forth and so on, and was also interested in photography. It just goes on and on from there to Rivers Frederick Junior High School, where Mr. Conrad, who was an industrial arts teacher, had taken one of the industrial arts closets and turned it into a dark room. And where I first, in seventh grade, where I first learned photography. As I said, there's a lot of intersecting lines that people don't quite understand all of the references in my work, because in a way I disguise them as ordinary or as things that are common to all people, but it has specific meanings to me. So Mr. Conrad taught us photography. And in teaching us photography, not only how to take pictures, but how to develop pictures, which before the advent of digital technology was a whole process that you took the picture, then you developed, you did the process with the negatives, and then you take the negatives and put them into usually an enlarger, unless you made a contact sheet. But the enlarger we use with the light to make the photo big and put it on photographic paper. I don't want to go into the whole process, but after that, you use that paper and put it in chemicals to treat it to make the photograph itself, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I learned the whole process from Mr. Conrad, taking the pictures, developing the negatives, with the process of developing the negatives, then printing the pictures with an enlarger. I favored the Omega enlarger. That's a whole nother story. Printing the pictures and then processing the pictures and the chemicals, hanging the pictures to dry. And once they were dried, using a dryer. I remember the first dryer we got. It's a whole process. And voila, you had a picture at the end of this long process, and you had to learn how to do it. And with the chemicals, you had to use them in a certain order, or you just completely mess up. And so I learned all of that. And so this picture of Rivers Frederick in the operating room as a physician, there's a picture of him that is used in my book that's coming out on photography, Seeing Black. There's a picture of him that was done by A.P. Baidu. And Baidu was the most talented photographer, in my estimation, that New Orleans ever produced. But long story short, all of that is in the writings and the work, but it's not in there in a biographical sense, but rather as a reference and a touch point for me that I know this is why I did this, or this is what influenced me to do that, and so forth and so on. And also the music. The music is all throughout what is called jazz, which many people don't realize developed in the 1920s and the 20s. Well, in the decade preceding the 20s, it developed and has continued throughout the history of the United States, to particularly the 20th century, to be the dominant musical form. And the jazz musicians could take anything that had been created and use it as a springboard for their improvisations and what have you. Long story short, so a lot of those poems.
Very strong influences for you.
Yeah, had references. And if you know some of the references, for instance, the song I Want to Talk About You, then you will understand how it impacted me emotionally. It has nothing to do with the precise meaning of the words per se, but those words came to me as a result of the two things I was, as a young person, that really deeply influenced me. One was photography. That was Mr. Conrad at Rivers Frederick Junior High School in seventh grade. And the other was poetry, and that was Mrs. Nelson at Rivers Frederick Junior High School in eighth grade. And she introduced me to Langston Hughes, who became, as I tell people, I'm not religious, but I have a patron saint, and that is Langston Hughes. And Langston Hughes, unbeknownst to me at the time, because I just liked a couple of the things that I heard, and it was important to understand it was what I heard, not what I read first. It's what I heard. Mrs. Nelson came in one day and told us, put your books away, I want you to hear something. And she had a small portable record player and put on a recording of Langston Hughes doing some of his poetry, one of which was a poem about a woman whose husband died in Harlem, and she went around begging for money to bury him because they were very poor. And the last lines of the poem were, "A poor man ain't got no business to die." And that, that really got to me. And so that was my entrance to Langston Hughes, whom it turned out I could not have chosen a better person, because Langston Hughes did not complete college. He attended Lincoln in Pennsylvania for a short time, but he was known as a poet, a blues poet on top of that. Was
a what poet?
Blues.
Okay.
The musical form, blues. In fact, his one book is called The Weary Blues. But he was also a playwright. He had a play produced on Broadway. He was also a biographer. And he wrote fiction. But most of his very famous short story, well, famous for me, what I consider famous, about a moment. It was just a moment. A woman was getting off a bus. And as she was getting off, a man was waiting to get on. And they passed each other briefly. They had been lovers in past years. But they just passed each other, and people in the crowd would never know. And he writes about that moment, that precise moment. And not on what happened after the man got on the bus or what happened after the woman got off the bus, but the moment they passed each other and recognized each other. And it's a very short piece, but it's poignant. It really resonates. So anyway, Langston Hughes did all kinds of work. And then as I studied him more, I found out that although he was not quote unquote college educated, he was trilingual, conversant in both Spanish and French, as well as in English. And in the French language, he had translated the major piece of literature developed out of Haiti by Jacques Romain, called The Masters of the Dew. And that piece is well known in Haitian literature, but is not, most people, you know, are not aware of it.
Tell me that name again.
Jacques,
J-A-C-Q-U-E-S.
U-Q-E-S, right.
I have a Jacques in my life, in my political life, and you know who that is, Jacques.
Yeah.
Well, it's both, it's Jacques Morel. Yeah.
Right, and Jacques Morel.
Sometimes he's in and sometimes we're out, but anyway.
Yeah. Jacques is a name that's common in the Haitian.
Sure.
But it's not common elsewhere.
Yeah.
And Jacques Romain, as I learned later, was in the 30s a member of the Communist Party and was considered a radical, which appealed to me because, of course, I was considered a radical. And you mentioned Jacques. But anyway, Jacques, turning this off. Jacques was, see if I can, there are no straight lines in anyone's life. But Jacques Romain was a communist and considered a radical of his, but he wrote this novel, Masters of the Dew. Jacques Morel of the Morel clan is considered the most radical of them.
Most radical of what?
Of the Morel clan.
Of the Morels. Yeah, I mean, radical is not a word I would necessarily well, that's because I'm prejudiced in favor of radicalism.
Yeah.
I think, radicalism requires change. And it's really, they're change agents.
Yeah.
They're people who believe that if there's a problem, You don't just live with it. You want to change the
You
circumstances.
Deal with it, yes.
And that was how I felt. That's why I left the Bronx, because there were too many circumstances in the way people lived in the Bronx that I didn't agree with. And so I felt I had to move on, and did move on to an apartment in the West Village.
Okay.
You know, my parents were horrified, but I definitely wanted to be able, and I've always been that. I've always tried to be, to the extent of my abilities, which are not great, a person who supports change. That's right. That's all I can say. I think that's the safest word. You know, I want to.
Before you go on, let me. Yeah. The other aspect of Langston. He was conversing in French, but he was also conversing in Spanish. And his translations of Federico Garcia Lorca, who is considered the national poet of Spain, and did both plays and poetry, Blood Wedding, and a number of other pieces, were translated by Langston Hughes, and his translations are used. The woman from, I believe it's Argentina, who won, who was a Nobel laureate, Gabrielle Mistral, Langston Hughes translated her poetry, it's in Spanish. And that translation that Langston Hughes did is often used because it's considered the best English translations of her work. And there have been a couple of books that have subsequently come out which explore Langston Hughes's trilingualism, and particularly his translation of Nicolas Guillén, who was the national poet of Cuba. I went to Cuba twice and became good friends with a Cuban poet. And she turned me on to this whole tradition of poetry from Cuba. So Langston Hughes was influential to me. I never learned other languages, but I was interested in the fact that Langston Hughes was a professional translator. When I say professional, I mean his translations are now used as major books and major works of various authors. And so he was with Nicolas Guillén in Cuba, with Jacques Romain in Haiti, and with Lorca in Spain. Langston Hughes's translations are considered the translations of those people.
So that is a kind of a soft lead into a fundamental question that I have about the choice to make poetry.
Mm-hmm.
So again, sometimes we choose a path that is not necessarily a given and not a safe choice, but it's one that changes us, not just who we want to change, but ourselves. And it is a difficult decision to make to do that, because again, how are you going to feed yourself and any others that you might have some responsibility for in life? So how did it come to be initially that you chose poetry?
I think the interesting question is, how did I choose to do other things? I think poetry is common to all people. We just all people don't know it. if you speak a language, that language is influenced. The language itself is influenced by the major wordsmiths of the language over the years. And so Langston Hughes, as an example, was the first major wordsmith, a published poet, to delve into the quote unquote vernacular songs of Black folk. And Langston Hughes became known as a blues poet, but he was interested in what the common folk had to say and how they express themselves. And so that's what language for me was, just it was just a verbal means of self-expression. And my belief, of course, is that every individual is a ball of, as the song says, a ball of confusion. That is, we have contradictions that exist within us, and we resolve our contradictions howsoever we resolve or don't resolve them. But that's the life of every individual.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I'm saying I don't know how it comes out in expressions of people. It differs. So people who grew up, I have two brothers, two younger brothers, and one ended up being a businessman and the other ended up being a physician, a cardiologist of note. But we all, I realized because of my parents, we all were, whatever you're gonna do, do it and do it well. Whatever it is you decide to do. The way I say it in terms of the folk is that my people taught me how to run, but did not tell me where to run to. That was my decision where I ran. But they made me strong enough to run and taught me how to be strong.
So I'm out of time, but I want to ask one more question. And I'd like to pick up with you on, I had a list of, you know, more than I knew I could handle in one interview, but I want to ask you why our culture bearers have been so persistent and long-lasting in their impact on our culture. In other words, why have traditional forms of art here, and they might not be a traditional seeming, but they're long-lived. I mean, there's cultural themes in the creative work of New Orleans that are centuries old. I mean, we talk about, you know, culture in New Orleans in the context of 300 years often is the number that I hear, and I don't know specifically what that means. And the other thing that I've been very curious about is when did culture in New Orleans become, what preceded the European form of culture and African forms of culture that developed here as, you know, there, as you said, as a result of a confluence of factors? But you don't hear as much, although increasingly now there's been a kind of opening of the envelope on the influences of the native indigenous tribes here, right? And so we're hearing more about Bulbansha has suddenly emerged as a word that a lot of people know the meaning of, and there are certain people who are responsible for that, who made that happen. But why has the roots of our culture maintained their profile as opposed to just being occasionally referenced as roots. They're still present. They're still very much a part of our daily lives.
Okay, you've asked a complicated question, and there's no easy or simple answer to it. But what I will do is boil it down to one factor: gumbo. Now, New Orleans is known as one of the culinary capitals of the United States. And the culinary aspect of New Orleans is often called Creole, for lack of a better term. In the original Spanish translations, the Creole meant that it was of quote unquote old world origin, but practiced in the new world with people who lived and who were born, lived and died in the new world. And we don't recognize today the distinction of old world and new world, but the Europeans thought of Europe and primarily Western Europe as the old world, and the Western hemisphere of the current United States as the new world. And in some documents you'll find that. Now, that process also meant something in that most of the European culture we deal with is either Anglo-Saxon, the English language, or the Romance languages, Italian, Spanish, and French. And so it gets translated in the United States. So you see the words themselves. And the Latin root of many words is often overlooked for the Spanish, the French, Italian, and the English usage of those same words. And most of us don't realize that these words often had they came from other places. The genesis was other places and other cultures and other contexts. Because I was interested in language as a poet, I would study some of these things on my own. And I didn't do it through school, but I was what was called an autodidact. That is, I studied on my own whatever the interests I had and so forth and so on. Again, I don't want to get into, but gumbo, it turns out, was from a West African word, inkumbo. And gumbo refers to a food that the Maroons carried. And the Maroons were the people who ran away from the plantations. And New Orleans, in southern Louisiana, is surrounded by marshland. They ran it off into the marshland. Now, the significance of gumbo is that it was all cooked in one pot because they couldn't carry around a whole set of pots and pans and what have you. They didn't have ovens, right? So how was the food preserved at the time? They didn't have a refrigerator or anything like that. What was done? Yeah, but there was one specific spice came from the bay leaf. And the bay leaf, when it's chopped up, it's called filet, right? And the filet powder from pounding the bay leaves is used. And it's still used in the making of gumbo. It's a thickener.
Sure. It defines it.
Yeah.
If it doesn't have filet, it's not gumbo.
So that's, and the filet is the sassafras leaves coming from the sassafras trees, ground up. And so gumbo could be made, was the primary, and it was a liquid base. And being in the marshlands, you had access to a lot of fresh and brackish water. The fresh water, of course, didn't have salt in it. The brackish water was slightly salty. And ground up filet sassafras leaves ground up to make the filet, and whatever meats you came upon or could acquire at the time, whether it be rabbit, chicken, cow, whatever, you know. And this was the food of the Maroons. And so when I found out that gumbo came from Nkumbo, that became the title of the major publication that we did. We did 9 issues, Nkumbo, N-K-O-M-B-O. And that, I was the co-editor and initially the junior editor, along with Tom Dent, who was my mentor on that. And I'm using that as one example of how the influences, we may not even recognize that it's an influence or where it came from. And it was an African influence, specifically the word, but also the usage and how it was developed. So it was all cooked in one pot with everything in it, including the filet and the meats that we might acquire all in one pot, and that's gumbo.
Well, I'm going to have to, I'm going to have to rethink gumbo for myself. It's one of the few, there are certain things that I have learned to cook here. You know, the Bronx was not a culinary capital, let me tell you. Even though it was a very mixed population, like any city is going to have that, but it wasn't.
Not any city in the New World.
In you the New World, yeah.
You have to look at the at the New
World, which reminds me of what my closing statement has to be, because we are out of time. I mean, and now we are not of time, out of time in our lives. So I fully intend and look forward to continuing our conversation and taking up some of the other issues that were on my list of things I wanted to focus on. So I hope you will have the patience and generosity to offer me more opportunities to talk with you further. And I'm really sorry that I hadn't done it sooner. As I said, I think I was a little intimidated by your profile, mm-hmm. and didn't really pursue. But I started doing this show, Crosstown Conversations, I'd Be Okay, about, I think it's, I can't remember chronology at all, but it's over 10 years ago. I've been apparently the oldest host on the air at Be Okay, other than Paul. Oh yeah. So I mean, I'm shocked to hear that. It's really weird to be, you know, this weird white girl hanging out. But I have loved it as one of my most important work experiences and life experiences. So I look forward to more of that with you in the future. But I got to close us off. I'm totally out of time. So thank you so much for making yourself available. And I hope that I look forward to the next conversation. But I'm going to let you set the pace for the next one. So you're going to tell me what you want to talk about, as opposed to the interviewer determining the conversation. Although you pretty much, I think you made some of the major points that you wanted to make, I hope.
Well, as to quote the culture,
there's a lot more.
I want to talk about you.
Oh, well, that's another complicated subject.
Well, for instance, over your left shoulder, there's a photograph on the bookshelf. And I don't know if that's Robert Kennedy or not. It could be.
It is. It's Robert Kennedy, and it's signed to me by Ethel. I worked for him in the campaign, and I unfortunately witnessed his assassination.
Yeah,
I wasn't in California. I was already in the next state. I was in New York, and I had left the television on and fallen asleep on it, and was suddenly awakened by the gunshots.
Uh-huh.
And so he was very important to me, because when I first met him, he was extraordinarily personal in his communication pattern. He wasn't talking to some, I was a young, there was a kind of two-tier system in the political workers, and I was a young, you know, I was on the young side, so my job was to handle the political work in Kokomo, Indiana. Kokomo, Logansport, Peru, and I'm missing one of the cities, but so I just had enormous respect for him because he was so personal in his communication, unlike some politicos. And he remains my standard of what a political person should be like. Yeah. Did you have experience with him?
No, I didn't have any experience with him personally. That was, but you said something that, I'll just give you the reference. Duke Ellington, one of his famous songs is Coco. And people don't know, you know, in general, they don't even think about Kokomo, Indiana. But the whole, the connection with Bix Beiderbecke and Davenport and so forth and so on.
I actually didn't make that connection.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And I follow jazz music. I mean, I used to be up all night until early. I had to go to sleep when the horse-drawn or mule-drawn carriages were on their way down my street to the Bronx Market that was on the, I guess that must be the Harlem River. I was affected by that, but he's one of my important mentors in taking a job that could be very hard to connect with people theoretically because you're having to connect with so many.
Yeah.
But he would look you in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
He would look you in the eye and communicate with you. And I appreciated that very much. If I don't close off, I'm going to have to edit too much. So we're going to continue. As I said, I'll let you determine what the subject matter will be, but we'll pick up kind of where we left off. Folks, this was Kalama Yasalam, who is, among other things, a poet and has been an important influence on people of different persuasions in New Orleans. His name is legendary, and I appreciated being able to spend some time with you. We'll do some more, okay?
Fine.
Thank you very much. You take care.
All right.
Stay healthy. Don't get sepsis. That was a little scary. Okay. Till the next time.
Okay.
Bye-bye.